You're listening to Heart of Mind Radio for the New Millennium. I'm Catherine Davis, host of this program, and we're doing an examination of spirituality in the age of crisis, the age of change, and the age of transformation. In this segment, we take another look at the prophecies of 2012 with Sergio Magaña, who explains that the true prophecy was representing a period of time, and that is illustrated in his book, Dawn of the Sixth Sun, from 2012 to 2021. So that means that we are at the peak, the transformation point of this prophecy.
It is a really very powerful book, and the title is The Dawn of the Sixth Sun. And for people to understand that, I'm thinking we might have to take a few steps back and explain what you mean by the sixth sun. What is the fifth sun, and what is this progression, so that people might understand this time period, 2012 to 2021?
Okay, yeah. Thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. Of course, the Nahuatl cultures, it's a long lineage that Nahuatl is a language that was spoken in the center of Mexico, and it comes from the Olmecs to the Aztecs. So it's like 5,000 years of wisdom, of lineage. The Aztec calendar is like the last part of and the tradition, the Mexica tradition of this knowledge. And in the calendar, the outer ring of the calendar means the long count. And the long count is of 26,500 years. That is more or less the precession of the equinoxes that the science and other traditions saw. So for the Aztec calendar and the Nahuatl cultures, the main number in the universe was the four, because they saw that it was repeated in a lot of parts in nature. For example, four main moments of the day that are sun rising, midday, sunset, midnight. Four phases of the moon, four elements, the two solstices and the equinoxes to complete the cycle. So they divided everything in four. And also the calendar is called Nahui Olin, four movements, because this pattern is repeated. So the long count of 26,500 years was split into four according to this pattern. Mm-hmm. And that gives you periods of 6,625 years. That is what we call suns. And now we are in a historic transition, because we the change for the Nahuatl culture, that is very similar to the Mayan one, but not exactly, started in a full eclipse that happened in Mexico City in 1991. And then this is when, for us, the changes are not exactly like in modern calendars, that one day is 2010 and the next day is 2011. No, for us, it's like in nature, that suddenly it's night and light begins slowly, then they are like midnight, midday, and then it gets to the sun rising. Mm-hmm. So for us, it's more like in nature, the change. So for us, the sixth sun entered in the kingdom, if we can say like that, of the fifth in 1991. They got like the equal power in the 2012. And now, slowly, the fifth sun is going out. And the transition will finish in 2021, when the sixth sun will be by itself for thousands of years.
Hmm. So can we speak of these two suns? What was the characteristic of the fifth sun that's leaving? And what is the sixth sun bringing in?
Of course. For us, the main division that people have, I think that the environment creates the traditions, because all the knowledge is adapted to the environment. We in Mexico are very equatorial, more equatorial than here. Mm-hmm. So we have like an average of night and day that doesn't change a lot in the year between winter and summer. Mm-hmm. So we get to the night at 7 almost all year long, and it's at 6 a.m. Probably we get the sun rising all year long. So if you see, it's almost half and half.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the ancient Mexicans, both Mayans and Mexicas and all those things, and Aztecs and Toltecs, mm-hmm. saw these two parts of us. That would be the night and the day. So the main division that the tradition created was night and day, and what we call tonal nahual. Tonal comes from tonatiuh, the sun. So it's who you are awake. For example, now I'm in the tonal giving all these mm-hmm. all these lessons. And nahual comes from negua. Negua is I, who I am really. And it's who are you sleeping and who you are death. So it would be like a kind of spirit. So for us, we were completely a different being than a wild that is an energetic body in your body, mm-hmm. if I can say. So who you are in the night. And so, for example, for us, energetically, you have the tonal surrounding your head in the daytime. And when you fall asleep, they change. And the Nahual that was in your navel, the energy of the Nahual that was in your navel goes to the head. That's why you enter in a complete different state of perception. So the main division for us is Tonal Nahual. And for us, the Nahual is very important because for the tradition, the who you are in the night will create who you are in the day. It has four times the power, the sleeping state has four times the power of the awake. And also in the big periods of the calendar, this division is still there. For example, we have a son of the tonal or a son of light, and then a son of the nahual, a son of darkness. It doesn't have anything to be with good or bad. It's just night and day. The fifth son was a son of light, of mm-hmm. the tonal, of the awake. These sons is like being awake in the day, that where are you seeing? Outside.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I am awake, I cannot see my inside. I am seeing now you, Kathy, Araceli, all the studio. So that's the main characteristics. In the Sons of Light, where those humankind put God outside. Satisfaction, outside. Medicine, outside. The conquest is outside. And if you see, while the sixth son was approaching, humankind is going again to the inside, generally. So it's like closing the eyes. And the inner self begins being very important. Medicine goes to the inside because it's not so effective outside. Religions begin falling down. And the dreaming state is becoming important also. So all the inside and the conquest is yourself. And if you see a lot of people now think that they weren't affected, but we are lucky because if you see this in theory and you are in the middle of a sun, mm-hmm. you cannot see really the change between one and the other. But I can remember how it was life 30 years ago. And people were satisfied by the outside, by the religious answers and all those things. It was not general see people facing really personal crisis and depressions and all the world of the inside. This is more new.
I totally agree, and I've seen that myself. I've experienced it myself. So this period of the dawn of the sixth sun, the reason this is important is because a lot of people before 2012 were expecting either great catastrophes or they expected like some immediate transition. And then after the fact, then many people, you know, people who are not in this tradition, who don't know, were very disappointed that the world didn't change for the positive, and they are very disappointed. So how does the teachings that you're bringing to those of us with Western minds help us in this 20-year period to understand how to move forward through this transitional time?
Okay, first of all, because a lot of people doesn't know where the 2012 stuff came from. Mm-hmm. It was from the ancient Mayan and Toltec traditions.
Yeah.
So it came from Mexico. But the problem is that in Mexico, these concepts are not so popular. This was all a complete stuff that was made abroad for some people that studied the calendars and all those things. Mm-hmm. But they went there, studied a little bit of the calendars. They translated a little bit of Nahuatl or Mayan into their frame of mind.
Mm-hmm.
And, for example, the Nahuatl prophecy was, the fifth sun will finish with earthquakes. There will be a lot of suffering and everyone will die. That is exactly prophecy. If you don't know how to translate now, and if you put it in the framework, that this means that the world will end. That's what happened. Mm-hmm. But they didn't know the ancient tradition, really, because they weren't there a lot of time. I have been there all my life, and I have been studying that. For the tradition, death means change. For example, death means dream. So they didn't see these parallels. So they just translated exactly how it came for a modern mind. And for example, for the tradition, there are six deaths that you experience alive. Mm. One is conception, because you stop being death to being alive. Then the birth was other death, because you stopped being in the womb of your mother to start being in the world. Then puberty, or when you it stopped, you stop being a child to become a young man or girl, yes. Was other death. So we have all these things. So death means changes. So earthquakes was meant that all the structures, because if you see the Aztec calendar, between the suns, there are four squares that represent the suns. The fifth sun is in the middle, and there are an eagle claws in the middle that represents that every time that we change suns, the order of the other sun is destroyed to give place to the new order. So now it's what we are facing. That the religions are being destroyed, or not destroyed, but they are falling down. Mm-hmm. The medicine, the structures, the economies. A lot of things are changing because we are entering in the new sun. But it's a sun of the Nahual, a sun of the inside, a sun of darkness. Mm-hmm. That it doesn't mean good or bad. It's just a different order, where the main conquest is inside.
Excellent.
I have read a lot of the stuff now that goes outside about Toltecs, and I said, wow, it's so different of the things that are said in Mexico. Beginning for the meaning, Toltec comes from a word that in Nahuatl is toli. Uh-huh. Toli means the measure. And they say, and it's also like a tree that was a robber, tule. So toli is, they say that it comes from the Olmecs. That the toli is the ones that have the measure, and they say the measure is in the universe. So the Toltec really tradition doesn't have to be with watch what you speak, be impeccable and nothing like that. It's mathematic completely, even for the meaning of the word toli. So is get the measures of the cosmos and try, like the Holy Father says, as it's in heaven, do it in the earth. But not just say it, do it. So our dances, our breathings, our everything is to get the measures of the sun, of the moon, of Venus, of the Pleiades, and everything, and to make our microcosmos tune in the toli, from which Toltec comes, with the universe. So it's nothing channeled, nothing an angel said. It's just watch the universe, the toli, the measures in the cosmos, and make those measures in your life. Through dance or drumming or whatever.
So in many ways, it seems that the sixth sun in which we are going inside is for that purpose, to finally have the human race reflect perhaps that those numbers and how they live their lives.
Yeah.
Do you think?
For example, the inside is also the underworlds. So in the sons of the Nahual, people must face, for example, the fact that almost everyone is losing consciousness while sleeping. And that cannot be like that, because one third of your life or more is being lost. And for the tradition, there is a Mexica phrase that says, the one that doesn't remember, it's very strong, is like a living dead, because doesn't have control of his awake. So that's the first fact that a sixth son brings, that you must face what you dream and learn how to control your dreams. Then the repetitive patterns that you are doing, they are going to be exaggerated until you solve them. The fear of change. Then the repetitive patterns of your ancestors that are really important. We are not free. If we think that we are free, there is other phrase that if you don't heal your ancestors, they are going to destroy you. And that is not that they are going to come and throw stones to you. No. You are just going to repeat their patterns. So all these things, the heavy emotions that you haven't got rid, And for us, if you solve your underworlds, you enter in the cave of power. That is to see these numbers, to see their reflection, to see the mirror, to learn how to move this reality because it's only the dream of the dream.
Mm. So what we're experiencing now is the dream.
Yeah,
the dream of the dream.
For us, this is the dream of the dream. This is the soup dream.
So that gives us the potential to either live our lives blindly, or as you say, if we can conquer the inside and learn to be awake in our dreams, then the dream we're creating here can be wonderful.
Of course.
Yeah. So until we learn to do that, we're going to create our own nightmares, I presume.
If you're living a difficult time now, it's because you have created in the dreaming state. And because now the energies have changed.
Yeah.
Everything that was outside is coming to the outside, to the inside. That's why so much people is facing this depression crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Because the outside is not enough anymore. And because it's not the time of the outside.
Yes.
Yeah. So a lot of people that have conquest, like we were talking there, that have conquest their financial solutions and all those things, they are facing the crisis of the inside. They are looking for something else because this is not the time of the outside.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you mean like people in politics, people in the economics world,
yeah,
they have to turn inside.
Yeah, a lot of people that have a good wife or a husband and a good family and the solution to their finances, all those things, they are not satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
Because now with the new sun, that used to satisfy everyone 30 years ago, if you see.
Mm-hmm.
And almost no one was like challenged. But now, people that have that, is not satisfied because the new sun is of the inside. You cannot get the satisfaction outside.
I recognize that. I think it would be great to get a little bit further into some of the details because you talk about the math and the measure. And I would like for people to understand the significance of the numbers as you taught us in the workshop, though you couldn't do the whole thing. But, you know, the 4, the 13, the 8, what are the significance of all the numbers with regard to the solar system?
Okay. The main one is the 1.
Mm-hmm.
In Nahuatl, 1 is se, or sen. So like I said yesterday, if you ask for 1 notebook, you will say, se notebook. Okay, not notebook, but the mm-hmm. worldly Nahuatl of what you're asking. But se, it's from sen comes the word sen teotl. Teotl is energy, the unified energy from which everything comes. So it will be like the equivalent of God, but a very different God because it doesn't have like human shape, not beard. It's not judging anyone and nothing like that. It's just what we call also Amomati, the state without mind, or the black eagle where everything starts. Then the second number that is very important in the Toli is the Ome, that is Ome Teotl. It is said that the black eagle or the main energy, in order to be able to create, has to reflect herself to create a subject object or an IU. And that's why for us is sacred the obsidian mirror, because it's the physical object that is the metaphor of the first reflection. So every time that we work with obsidian mirrors is that we say when we would try to destroy a sickness or a problem, you say where you create it is in the only place that you can destroy it, in the mirror, in the reflection. So the main energy, the first thing that reflected was Ometecutli Omesihuatl, that literally from Nahuatl means Mr. Tu and Mrs. Tu, the Mexican yin-yang. But that's in the reflection. And from that, from the two, that so we have this kind of sacred word that for us is Ometeotl. Ometeotl is like the Mexican amen. But it really means like the two energies joining to create or to reflect. So after that, all the cosmos was created with these two energies. So for us, all the cosmos, the stars, even the point more far away that you can see is in the reflection, in the mirror. And they say that we are so fascinated by the reflection that we have forgotten completely the one that reflects.
Mm-hmm.
So we are kind of trapped in the mirror. So that gives like the meaning of the 1 and 2. Then it's the 4, that everything, like I said, is repeated in 4 movements, in nature, 4 seasons, 4 phases of the moon, solstices, equinoxes, to give the complete cycle. Then it comes the eight. The eight is very important for us because it's the mathematic of Venus and the moon. So, and for us, Venus and the moon establish the difference between Tonal and Nahual. Because if you see in the ancient times, Venus was seen like a star, the brightest star of the sunset and of the sun rising that disappears at the end. Mm-hmm. So it's like Venus opens the kingdom of the moon and then closes the kingdom of the moon to open the kingdom of the sun. The difference between Tonal and Nahual. So it was like a very complicated to explain in radio equation of the cycles of Venus and the moon that leads you to the number eight. But this is very important because even for the tradition, that's why you should sleep 8 hours. And you have, for us that we have lucid dreaming, you only experience eight dreams per night, every night. And a lot of people that say, oh no, I have more, they don't have more. If they join the complete dream, one dream that looks different is a continuation of the same dream. But if you have lucid dreaming, really, you will see that everyone sleeps eight dreams every night. Even if you sleep 4 hours or six, It will be repeated in those patterns because we are just reflection of the Toli. We cannot escape from the Toli, from the measure.
That's amazing. And what about the 13?
Because
we use that in the breathing as well.
Yeah, the 13 for us is the number of the Quetzalcoatl. Quetzalcoatl means the rising of the serpent, that would be like the Mexican Kundalini, but it's also like the archetype of knowledge, of kindness, of power, of the enlightened one. And it has to be with our relationship with the sun. The sun rotation in the equator, in the solar equator, is of 26 days. So if you divide that in two, because it's two phases of the sun, it will be 13. In the sun poles, it's like 20 days, 20 something. So it would be 10. So that's why for us the 13 is sacred, because it's like having in the earth a different phase of the sun, a different solar wave. That's why we divide the calendars in 13 days or in 20 days.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. I would love for people to understand what these metaphors are, like using the fire elements, understanding the nature of the animals, not just the serpent, but you spoke of the eagle, and you know, some kind of connection that people can make to the importance of these symbols in the teaching.
Our archetypes that are older than Christianity and any religion are animals. Mm. So the serpent is not just the serpent. In Mexico, you see there is the enlightened one was named the serpent feather. That is based in a spiritual practice. Almost anyone knows that is the rising of the serpent that then exits your body and transforms into a bird that will take you to fullness. But the serpent it was very sacred for us because they knew that the energy moved like a serpent in waves. So every time that we say serpents, we are referring to the movement of the energy. Mm. For example, the crocodile was the ancient symbol that represented the Mother Earth. And it was said that the Tezcatlipoca, the Lord of the Darkness with the Quetzalcoatl, the Lord of the Light, in a legend, were kind of fighting for the earth, and they were pulling one jaw and the other jaw, and then they broke it. And from it came the creation. That it means, it is like a metaphor of the yin-yang, the black and the white energy, and it came the creation of the fifth sun. So we have the eagle. The eagle is the spirit flying, the eagle warriors, the eagle seer in the dreams. We have the hummingbird. The hummingbird for us is the one that makes impossible things, the one that represents the love, the joy. So all these archetypes that we use in dreaming a lot. For example, the monkey, the arts, that is Osomachtli, it's Quintli, the dog that goes to the land of the dead to meet the ancestors. We have all these kind of archetypes that are there.
Well, it's beautiful for me because it really does help to, it explains, it helps me to understand what it is that you're teaching. So it's not just a strange metaphor, but it actually gives it vision and gives it life for me when I understand using those archetypal metaphors, and I think that that's a really wonderful thing.
Come to the river, meet me by the water. Come on and join me, I'll be waiting by the shore. Stand in a circle, with love and arms around you, yeah. Lay down your burden, any load too big to carry. Yeah, come to the river where the healing waters flow. There will be mountains to climb and valleys dark as the night, and roads you have never known. Follow the answers to the questions in your soul, down by the water where the river gates control. Ooh, 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 yeah. Mighty
Well, I didn't have it until I was 36, mm-hmm. and it came after 10 years of intense longing and practice and prayer and meditation. I'd been instructed by a great Tibetan teacher in Ladakh and taken the vows of Mahayana Buddhism. I'd plunged into Sufism and worked with the poetry of Rumi and been instructed by great Sufi teachers. I had worked passionately with a great Hindu teacher, and I had really, really longed and hungered and burned and yearned, and I had had a series of smaller mystical experiences that had completely convinced me of the essence of the divine, that the divine is here and the divine is in us. So it was the culmination of an enormously intense period of discipline, and it happened in Paris. I was living in Paris, and I'd actually been to dinner with great friends, and it had been a wonderfully happy dinner, and I went back, and I was living in a tiny little maid's room which was surrounded by mirrors, and I walked in and looked in the mirror and saw that there was nobody there, and it was very scary. And then, until I saw that everything was dancing, there was like flames dancing in the mirror. And I walked unsteadily to the window and opened the window, and it was an 18th century courtyard with Paris behind, and everything disappeared, and just white light, white diamond light. And because I was a scholar and a student of mystical literature, I knew that what I was receiving was the initiation, enlightenment experience. It's just the beginning. It sounds very grand, but it's actually 101. This is just hundreds of thousands of people have had this experience. The whole universe was just white light. I couldn't see anything, just this light, this amazing diamond white light. And the light isn't something you see out there. You know that you are one with this light. It and you are the same. And you can't explain that. It's just what you know when you have this experience. And the light is also joy. It's also bliss. It's also sweetness. It's also calm. It's immense, immense love, love beyond imagining. And I was drowned almost in this sea of light. And then I stood there and stood there and stood there. It went on for many, many, many minutes. And then the universe reappeared. But this time, everything that I thought was so solid looked very, very gentle, and it was suffused with light. So everything was glowing, and I understood beyond thought that everything that we see is actually a crystallization of light energy. And this goes exactly with what modern physicists are saying. You see, the most cutting-edge science and the deepest mysticism are now arriving at a marriage. And this is the essence of reality. And knowing the mystical traditions as I do, I know, and as many people do, that this experience has been had by people all over the world in all of the different religions. This is the essential experience of the nature of the universe. And it's open to everyone who wants it, because the divine is not trying to protect this secret. The divine is longing to give this secret to everybody. But you have to turn up in the relationship. You have to do the work. You have to work. You have to love. You have to turn up. And that's not because God is a sadist. It's because God wants you to have the ultimate experience, which is the rapture and the bliss of knowing the reality.
I've been traveling down this river. So many rocks pop up in my sight.
You're listening to Heart of Mind Radio for the New Millennium. I'm Catherine Davis, host of this program, and we're doing an examination of spirituality in the age of crisis, the age of change, and the age of transformation. In this segment, we're speaking to Andrew Harvey, a British author, religious scholar, and teacher of mystic traditions, known primarily for his popular nonfiction books on spiritual or mystical themes, beginning with his 1983 A Journey in Ladakh. He is the author of over 30 books, including The Hope, A Guide to Sacred Activism, The Direct Path, The Critically Acclaimed Way of Passion, A Celebration of Rumi, The Return of the Mother and the Son of Man. He was the subject of the 1993 BBC documentary, The Making of a Modern Mystic, and is the founder of the Sacred Activism Movement. And when I wake up in the morning, I hope I see you in the light, yeah. In the morning, in the morning. In the morning, in the morning.
I was born in India. And to be born in India is to be born in a world which is loved as sacred. So from the beginning of my life, I lived with people who found everything sacred, the rivers, the trees, the flowers. And although I was born to Protestant parents, I had a Hindu cook, I had a Catholic nurse, I had a Muslim driver, and from very early on in my life, I understood that there was one divine force and many ways of connecting with it and expressing it in reality. Mm-hmm. I was sent to school when I was 9 in England, and I felt as if I'd been locked in a refrigerator, because after the warmth and the passion and the joy and the beauty and the splendor and the religious intensity of in India, England felt frightfully cold. But I overachieved wildly, and when I was 21, I was elected to be a Fellow of All Souls. A Fellowship to All Souls is the highest English academic honor, and since I had absolutely no money, I was completely thrilled. But the next years were not happy years. I wasn't a happy young man, because I really understood that the world was falling apart, and my own life was falling apart. When I was 25, I returned to India, and I had a series of overwhelming mystical experiences which took me completely by surprise, because I had become a Marxist in my teens. I had decided that that was the only way the world could possibly be transformed, was by political revolution. And here I was going back to India, not expecting anything but to return to the roots of my own childhood. And a series of tremendous mystical experiences woke me up to another kind of reality. I then went on a very serious spiritual journey. I went up into the Himalayas to Ladakh, where I met a very powerful and beautiful Tibetan teacher. I went to live in Paris, where I studied with Sufi mystics. Sufism is the mysticism of Islam. I plunged into Hinduism by becoming the disciple of a Hindu teacher. And at the age of 36, I had an awakening experience. The whole world disappeared into divine light and then reappeared, soaked and saturated with divine light. And I realized that everything is a manifestation of the consciousness of God, and that we are all united with that consciousness in the deepest part of ourselves. I asked myself then the question, why have I had this realization? What is this realization for? And I had the honor of interviewing the Dalai Lama on the day that he won the Nobel Prize in Oslo in 89. And I asked him at the end of the interview, Your Holiness, This is an absurd question, but what is the meaning of life? And at that moment, he laughed and laughed and laughed and laughed, because as everybody knows, one of the greatest things in this world is the laugh of the Dalai Lama. And I have this project of making a CD in which it would have on one side the laughter of the Dalai Lama, on the other side the purring of my cat. So between the two sounds, I think a great deal of consolation could be shared. But he gave me the most amazing answer. He said, the meaning of life, Andrew, is to embody the transcendent. Not to go off into the transcendent, not to go off into the light, not to leave this world, but to embody it, to bring it down into your mind, into your heart, into your body, into your will, and into your actions. And that was a perfect answer, and it set me on a journey which went through many, many, many different permutations, but led me to the vision of what I call sacred activism that I am now sharing with as many people as I can get my hands on. And my book, The Hope, arose out of a lifetime spiritual search. What I believe is this. I believe that love doesn't mean a hill of beans unless we act on behalf of the voiceless, the oppressed, the damaged, the disinherited, the degraded. And I also believe that the deepest meaning of our crisis, this tremendous and shattering and very menacing and very difficult world crisis that we are now so obviously living through, is that it is a crisis designed to galvanize a comatose and paralyzed humanity into claiming the sacred power of divine consciousness within, and then putting it into radical, wise, clear, focused action on every level, very, very fast. Not just to save the planet, which is obviously now in tremendous danger, but also to help us go to the next evolutionary stage of our own evolution. We are a very damaged humanity at this moment, but the divine is within us, and the crisis is saying to each one of us, get off your ass, do something, love the world, and put your love into action. Choose something you care deeply about, and join with others to do something real about it. Everybody can do this. And since my book came out 2 years ago, it's had a tremendous reception. Many, many thousands of people have read it. And all over the world, people are responding to this call, which is why, despite all the facts, despite all the evidence, despite all the pain and horror and sadness that is erupting everywhere, my heart is now filled with hope. I know that we are going to get through. It's going to be very difficult, but there are on the earth hundreds of thousands of ordinary, humble, simple, decent people who now realize just in what danger we are, and who are willing, increasingly willing, to put their lives at stake, to do something real about the situation. So that's my life.
And a beautiful message it is that you bring with your life.
It's the message, really, of all of the great teachers of humanity, and I don't count myself amongst them. I'm not worthy to wash their underpants or do their shoelaces, but it's the message of Jesus, it's the message of the prophet, it's the message of the Buddha, it's the message of Ramakrishna, it's the message of everybody who wakes up. Mm-hmm. God is real, there is a divine presence in everyone and in everything, and the only possible response to that presence is to love and serve all beings. And that is the only thing that will ever make anyone truly happy. Because all the other things that we look for can be destroyed, but the presence can never be destroyed. And the joy that you get from helping people and serving animals and really being a part of this great new birth that's trying to take place on the earth, that joy is not something that anything can take away from you, because that joy the world cannot give or take away. That is an internal joy. And that's the great secret of life. Everybody somewhere knows that. There's a marvelous story about Mother Teresa, which I'd love to tell you. This is such a great story. This is a story actually told by a friend of mine. Mother Teresa just had a series of heart attacks, and she was very, very ropey. I mean, she was fragile, and the nurses were very worried about her, the other nuns. And one day a big businessman came to see her, and he was dripping with gold and jewels, and he fell on the floor and he said, "Oh, Mother Teresa, you are the greatest person that's ever lived on this earth." And she got extremely embarrassed, and she said, "Okay, get up." And she says, "Why do you think this?" Just laughing. And he said, "Oh, because you have given up everything." And she said, "Stop right here." She said, "You are the one who's given up everything. You've given up meaning. You've given up passion. You've given up joy. You've given up the meaning, passion, and joy that come from really knowing that with all your faults and follies and flaws, you are truly trying to do something for other people. I have not given up anything. I am filled with the joy of God. Not because I'm a good person, but because I've just turned up and every day tried to do my best. So until you realize that it is you who is the real renunciate, you really don't know anything about life." And he freaked out and ran out of the room. But that's one of the great stories. And
that's a great story.
It goes to the core of life, I think.
That's a beautiful story, in fact, because I think that's where most people get lost.
Yes.
In thinking that someone who's giving service has given up and given up themselves, and thinking that those who embrace the material wealth and the value of things are the ones that are doing the smart thing. So, but the truth is, and we can see it in the media, those people who are embracing wealth and fame are not doing so well.
Well, they don't seem that happy to me.
On a personal level, they don't seem to be doing that well.
How could you?
And so perhaps we can talk to our listeners a bit, because we're talking to regular folk.
Of course.
Who
I'm a regular folk. Sort
who
of.
Don't make much, but give a lot in terms of our radio station. People who don't make much tend to give quite a lot when it comes to
the poorer
things like that.
People are always the one who are the most generous. I lived in India for so long, and don't go to the rich, go to the poor for help, because they're the ones who know what life is. Mm. Right.
So true. So, but what I would like to speak to is your transition from being like a Marxist to understanding this the spiritual essence within you, because that's where a lot of people are who listen to this radio station. They're very involved in the politics, and people tend to get so attached to their politics that it almost, I would say it's almost a violent attachment to a certain way of thinking. And they tend to exclude other ways of thinking or diminish other people's expression. And I'm curious to know how that transition was expressed in your life from Marxism.
Such a wonderful question. First of all, I have the greatest reverence for Marx. I think Marx was a completely brilliant person who understood, especially the early Marx, the real nature of power and how injustice is fueled by economic factors. This is very important, because anybody who reads Marx with an open heart knows that money and power go together and injustice follows. And those structural connections are extremely, extremely precise. And I think one of the terrible things that happens in American society is that greed manipulates people into decisions that blind them to the effects of greed. The millions of people who are living on almost nothing, the appalling treatment of animals, the devastation of the environment. So my spiritual shift has not led me to be less political. Mm-hmm. I am as political as I was when I was 18, and I see things, if possibly, even more clearly, but they're lit up by a different light. Mm-hmm. What happened was that I was born to a religious family, and I was surrounded by ordinary, simple, but very deeply religious people when I was a child in India. So I was brought up in that atmosphere. Then I lost my faith and I plunged into political passion. And then I had, as I said, these extraordinary experiences of divine clarity, of divine beauty, and of this immense force. One experience I'd love to share with you, I was living I was 25 and I was living by the sea in South India, and I had dinner and I was walking back to the hotel, which was by the sea, and suddenly it was as if my head had been split open like a coconut that had been axed, and I saw this white diamond light being emanated from everything, and I heard this great sound that the universe was saying, which is the Om sound. I didn't know anything about Om at that time. I understood beyond thought that everything that I'd learned, and I'd been wildly overeducated. I mean, I'd read everything, and I'd been elected a professor at Oxford, you know, fellow of all souls and all that. Everything I had learned had not prepared me for this experience, which was obviously the truth. When you have a mystical experience, there, you can't hide from it. You can't pretend it's not going on, because it's so overwhelming and so self-evidently real and true and powerful that you cannot deny it. So I realized that I had to plunge into this. I could not turn away, and that it contained the secret not only for my own personal happiness, and I was unhappy and I needed to feel that there was something worth living for, but it also increasingly became clear to me that this experience was also the key to the force, the power, that if we humbly could harness it, would be a force and power that could change the horrifically unjust structures of our world. So I never lost my political passion, but I understood that there's a force greater even than human reason and human outrage and human indignation and human effort. There is a divine force of love, a divine force of absolute compassion that supports these human efforts for justice, and it's bringing together the divine power of love with the human passion for justice that is the core of sacred activism. And that's what my message is to people. And my message to Occupy, I talked to Occupy on several occasions. I said, thank you so much for turning up and giving us hope. Thank you for your courage. Thank you for your wildness. Thank you for your analysis. But understand that this is going to be a long haul. And to be strong enough and clear enough and patient enough and wise enough, we are all going to need more than human help. We're going to need help from the source of power itself. And that source is available to everyone. It lives in everyone. It's been known since the beginning of time. All the great religions are founded in it and spring from it. All the great mystics talk about it. And you don't have to be Einstein or Shakespeare or Rumi to get in contact with it. You just have to be willing and humble and admit you don't know and ask for help, and it will come to you and it will infuse you. And with the power that it gives, you can do anything, and you can shift this madness and turn this chaos into order.
Wow, very powerful. What's really interesting in working in the environment that I'm in is that I come into contact with a lot of elders, activists, you know, people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s who've been holding on to their vision and their hope for decades.
Yes.
But are so exhausted.
Yes.
And then I see these younger people who are coming to it now, and they came with all this enthusiasm.
Yes.
But then they confronted the violence of the police state.
Yes.
And now they're beginning to show signs of real exhaustion.
Well, this is the big problem.
Yes.
If you only rely upon your human power, you will not be able, and let's get absolutely real about this, you will not be able to shift structures so dark, so desperate, so ferocious, and so ruthless as the structures that now control the world. Mm-hmm. All of the great movements that have truly transformed history, all of them that I can think of, and I'm thinking of the way in which Gandhi unseated the British Empire, I'm thinking about the way in which Martin Luther King prevented a horrific bloodbath in American society by holding up the splendor of the Christ consciousness. I'm thinking of the way in which the Dalai Lama has held together Tibetan society in the middle of the fire of one of the greatest genocides of history. I'm thinking of the way in which Lech Walesa organized Solidarność and enabled the Polish people to move from oppression into democracy. I'm thinking about these people who've shown us the way, way, all of these people and all of these real movements have had to go deeper than merely human energy. They've had to tap into the essence of spiritual power to find the three things that you're going to need to make a movement of justice successful. You're going to need tremendous patience. You're going to need tremendous energy. And you're going to need tremendous wisdom. Patience runs out, I find, if you're just relying on your human self. Energy is easily depleted by defeat after defeat and disappointment and really seeing the ugly face of the fascism that threatens us. And wisdom, quite simply, cannot be attained without inspiration from the source of wisdom. Mm-hmm. So when you really understand this, you understand that the kind of movement that is necessary for our world to be preserved must be one that brings together the two most noble fires of the human soul, the fire of the passion for God that has been with us since the beginning of our creation journey and that has informed so much of the greatest of achievements of humanity, that and the fire of the passion for justice. And when you bring these two fires together, a third fire is created, which is the fire of love and wisdom in action. And we have seen this fire transform history again and again and again and again. And the time is now to birth this fire on an unprecedented scale and with unprecedented intensity of concentration, so that the world, whose very existence is now absolutely threatened, can not only be saved and preserved, but that so that we can be transformed by our passion into another kind of humanity that will never, ever, ever again allow such a global horror of oppression to arise.
Whatever happened to the sun?